Why are they shaking their head? We're stuck in slow life. Is it the beating of the chest that makes us feel the rest?
Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my interview with Matthew Alford. Hey, Matt, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon, broadcast at 11 a.m. Saturdays and 3 p.m. Tuesdays on 101.9 FM KVSH. You can also learn more about the show at voiceofvashon.org or visit my website, marchtwisdale.com, and you can pick it up as a podcast. So Matt, to get us started, I'm going to ask if you can give our listeners a sense of who you are, what you do, you know, basically ground yourself for us.
I am Matthew Alford. I'm from Great Britain. I live just outside London, and I work at several different universities and colleges. And my main research area for the last sort of 15 years, 10 or 15 years, has been on Hollywood cinema, and particularly on the politics of Hollywood. And so I've written a new book called National Security Cinema, where we have lots of documentation from the Department of Defense and from the CIA and other organizations, which basically show how the government has been involved in manipulating entertainment for its own ends. That's kind of my research field.
Right. And so that reminds me, I should let everyone know that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the board, staff, underwriters, or donors of Voice of Vashon. As an organization, VOV does not take political positions. We do support our show hosts and their guests in expressing their views, as long as they're not obscene or hate-mongering. So thanks for listening to the show, folks, and we're going to move on. Okie doke. So Matt, yes, I am really looking forward to this interview, and I've got a nice, interesting list of ways that we can sort of approach this issue. Now, real quickly, as far as the book itself is concerned, it would be available, I think, if people want to check it out. Would they go to your website? Do you have a website about this?
You just have to go to Amazon. Tom Secker, the co-author, has a website called spyculture.com. which is not just about the book, but is a very wide range of really interesting little videos that he's made, documentaries, clips, articles, podcasts, about everything to do with the relationship between the spy world, the clandestine services, war, entertainment, films, TV, those kind of areas. It's a brilliant website. So go to that one, but I don't have my own site.
And that's Tom Secker, S-E-C-K-E-R?
That's right, yes.
Okay, beautiful. All right, folks. So we all love our Hollywood movies. They're great recreation, entertainment, education, right? We love our documentaries. But sometimes if you're like me or basically breathing and thinking as a human being, you're sitting there watching a movie and sort of wondering, well, is there a background message here, or why is it being portrayed in the way it's being portrayed? The one that has always jumped out for me and caused me to practically want to flee the theater screaming is the Transformer series. As a mom with two sons, I find the series to be really, really interesting in how it portrays ideas of the military to children. It sort of reminds me of when Camel cigarettes were taken to court because they were using this cartoon camel to sell cigarettes, and it was basically pointed out that it was selling cigarettes to children. So what is it you guys discovered? Let's just start with Transformers, because I got a lot of parents out there who I think might be interested in this.
Transformers is, I wouldn't necessarily say it's even the worst offender in terms of presenting some kind of grotesque sort of national security perspective on the international world, on the internet, on the US role in the world. But it is possibly the most the production with the most support from the military that has ever occurred. It has all branches of the military have been involved in that franchise, and they have therefore a great deal of control over the script. They want to present the military in a very good light. They want to make sure that there is no nothing dissenting about those productions. It counts, I think, quite clearly because of the enormous explosions and the use of violence in there as something that would be called classic war pornography. I would say that the because the people behind this movie, Steven Spielberg as executive producer and Michael Bay as director and I think producer on one of them, these people were not likely ever to be making an anti-war statement anyway. So it's not like it's one of those films that one of those series or franchises that has been reworked heavily by the military. In fact, the military loved the series so much that they have, on various installments, begun work on those installments even prior to having signed a contract with the producers, because they're so confident that the ideological message promoted by these productions would be favorable to the military and to its recruitment efforts.
Okay, so this is so let's go ahead. What I want to make sure for my audience out there, for folks, all of you who are listening right now, is that we are all aware of that idea of ooh, the people in the dark room who are doing something, and we've been trained to believe that that's never the case, blah blah blah. Okay, so what we're not doing here, what you did not do with this book, was basically throw a bunch of opinion out here. Your book, if I understand correctly, is based upon essentially a bunch of real documents that have been brought to light and analyzed. And so let's just start with that real quick. How did you and your co-writer sort of stumble upon the hardcore evidence of what's going on?
Well, there are two big sort of chunks of evidence, if you like. One points to the scale of this operation by organizations like the Department of Defense and the CIA, but also to some extent the White House and FBI, that's been going on for 100 years or so, really since the dawn of Hollywood. And that's these organizations cooperating with producers, giving them things like tanks and aircraft carriers and assistance to offer in exchange for which they can use on screen in exchange for being able to make script changes. Now that's one thing. And the big headline that Tom and I found by getting loads of government documentation through the Freedom of Information Act was that whereas, say, at the turn of this century, about 15 years or so ago, if you'd asked any academic, including people who are specialists in the field, how many films have been affected like this? They'd have said roughly 200. Now we know that there are thousands of films that have been affected over the past century through this means, which means that by any measure, Tom and I think that it is fair to say that the role of the these major national security organizations is 5, maybe even 10 times larger than anyone has previously been able to substantiate. And that's what we're bringing that's new. That is a major thing. Like you're talking about a smoke-filled room kind of conspiracy. That, we are basically plugging into that narrative a little bit and saying, well, yeah, there is a bit more of that than anyone previously knew. Because at least in terms of like manipulating Hollywood film scripts and the scale of that operation. But then there's the second thing, the second bunch of stuff that we have acquired, which has been because we acquired all of that within a sort of 2 year or so period. But the rest of it has been acquired over a 5, 10, or even 15-year period, in much more in dribs and drabs. And that is what kind of effect have these government organizations had on the script? How have those scripts been rewritten?
Right.
When
So I live on an island with a lot of artistic people. We have a huge artistic community here, and in general, the belief, desire, hope, or mythology in America is that you have artistic license, and that we get out of the way of people who are doing artistic work, whether it's a play or a movie or whatever. And so maybe you could go ahead and give, I think right now, maybe give a couple of your best examples of how the artistic world it runs into the controlling permission militaristic side of what's going on and is actually hampered or not allowed to do what they wanted to do and is told, well, if you want this, then you have to do that.
Okay, so I'll give you two, just a couple of examples off the top of my head. There is, look at the film Meet the Parents, a comedy about CIA. In that, Ben Stiller's character walks into an office, which is his father-in-law's office, and looks around and he sees lots of intimidating photographs of his father-in-law, Robert De Niro, with people like Bill Clinton and with Arab sheikhs and so on. In the original script, that was written as Ben Stiller looking around that intimidating office and seeing not photographs, which are quite kind of benign in a way, but CIA torture manuals. Now, that is an indicator, but of course, that was the CIA requested that that scene be changed to have, pictures of Bill Clinton on the wall instead.
Wait. So the artistic goal was to present the father as being someone who had been involved in some of the dark and very unpleasant and unethical behavior of the CIA, and they were going to show, as you say, torture manuals or things like that. And instead, they were required to present what really is more of a glamorizing image of his father shaking hands with these world leaders who were supposed to essentially look up to and trust.
Yes, and that's just a little example. That's a little nice little example that people often find unexpected because it's just a silly comedy. You don't really expect the CIA to make requests. Obviously, remember that the organization, these producers were not required to make those changes. None of these organizations, the CIA, Department of Defense, can actually wield a stick over these people. It's all done voluntarily. And so, really, although this particular book is quite critical of the CIA and Department of Defense, ultimately it is actually the creative people that should be kind of resisting the temptation to go to run cap in hand to, say, the Department of Defense, saying, "Oh, please, sir, we need some Black Hawk helicopters." They should find ways around that, or there should be a change in the law to ensure that if such equipment is provided, it doesn't come with basically secret or semi-secret script changes as a quid pro quo.
So what you're saying
So,
is that every time we watch a movie and there is military equipment in that movie, these are not like, it's not like Hollywood has some field full of, these pieces of equipment that they've purchased that are leased out or rented out to various producers of movies. They're the real thing that are being actively used by the military, and the producers request permission to use them in the film. And when they request permission to do that, it comes with strings attached.
exactly, yeah. And in fact, what you've just described there, as what you kind of assumed previously, that there is some kind of field somewhere that's got all of this old equipment that's dumped there that could be used by any filmmaker for a, without any strings attached, doesn't sound like that bad an idea for a way of actually allowing Hollywood to continue to make high quality productions, but without there being such a political penalty to pay.
So every time my listener sits down and watches a movie like Salt with Angelina Jolie, there's a number of times where you've got military equipment, helicopters and whatnot being used, or the that zombie movie, War, what is that? World War Z or X or something? Yeah, that had lots of military in it. So every time we see military, what do you call it, materials, I don't know, what military equipment being used in a movie, you can automatically know that that came along with a contract that said, we're going to check your script and we're going to go ahead and issue script change demands. At that point, it is a demand because if you don't allow us to change the script the way we want you to, we will simply not allow you to use the equipment.
I guess it's fair enough to call it a demand at that stage because by that point they will be contracted in. To do what the, in the case of the Department of Defense, to do what they say. CIA is different. The CIA doesn't have any contracts as far as we're aware. CIA doesn't even seem to write anything down. CIA just goes around persuading writers and others to use their great ideas. They haven't got as much clout as the Department of Defense because they don't have access to aircraft carriers and helicopters and so on.
So but what, I would, so what are your examples? Yeah, go ahead. What do you, I want some examples of the how the CIA has been shown through perhaps the information that you have to do this.
I'll give you some examples of CIA involvement in just a second.
Yes.
But just to say, it's not quite as bad as the picture you present. Mm-hmm. For example, I think although World War Z or World War Z was a film that kind of a misanthropic film and kind of maybe a militaristic film or whatever, I don't think that I don't think the producers actually asked for military equipment there, because sometimes you can acquire, say, helicopters from other sources, from private sources. It's only when you really need the big stuff that only the military can provide.
Well, they had an aircraft carrier in that movie.
Ah, okay. I have seen that film, but maybe that's one to add. It could well be one to add, because yeah, we know that if they had an aircraft carrier in it, yeah, it will have been. And what usually happens is at the end of the film, say, right at the end of the credits, with thanks to the Department of Defense. I don't think they did at World War Z, because I'm one of the strange people that always stays at the end of the film and watches the end credits.
Right.
To run to see if it says at the very end, with thanks to the Department of Defense. And I'm sure that when I went to World War Z, that was another one of those that I stayed.
Right.
But you know, that's not to say that it wasn't there, because there are also a handful of unacknowledged cases, including the James Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies, for example, where the military does help, and in that particular case, does make script changes, because in that particular James Bond film, there was a joke about the United States losing Vietnam, and so they asked for that to be removed. Mm. And there's a couple of other examples along similar lines where, yes, those things can always happen. But I would say that I wouldn't want your listeners to think it's all hopeless.
No, of course not.
If you look at a say a film like Independence Day is a really good example, where it looked like the Department of Defense was going to provide a lot of support, and they had months of negotiations, because the Pentagon wanted the filmmakers to change they wanted to stop the Roswell alien landings and Area 51. They wanted to disassociate those two things, events or places, disassociate them with the government and with the military.
Hmm.
Obviously, the producers of that film, Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich, eventually just said, no, we can't do that. That completely ruins our script. So they said, right, sod it. We'll use computer-generated images.
Interesting.
And so they were able to do that. So I would say that something like, if you watch a film and it's got big military equipment on it, there's something like a 50% chance that it's had DOD involvement, but it's not quite as hopeless as you know, every single thing is covered by the Pentagon and they've got everything controlled. But the fact is that they do have a much greater reach than any other scholar of any kind or journalist had said until Tom and I have come out with this information over the past year or two.
Right. Okay, so real quick, Matt, I'm going to go ahead and remind everyone who they're listening to. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. And today I'm having a great time talking with Matthew Alford. We have been talking about national security cinema, the shocking new evidence of government control in Hollywood. And as you said earlier, this book written by you and your co-writer, Tom Secker, literally exposes a bunch of information that was found over the past 2 years, I believe, which prior to that, everyone who researched this issue had a completely different expectation of how much manipulation was going on. And through the Freedom of Information Act, you guys were able to really delve deep. So we are going to go ahead and jump from what we were just talking about really quick, because you were saying how producers and directors are sometimes able to say, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say no to the request from the Department of Defense, and we're going to go with completely computer-generated stuff. And you mentioned that as a way that they could maintain their artistic freedom simply by refusing to use actual military locations or equipment or whatever. However, you also have, I'm going to look over here on my list here, in the contents, you list Avatar as one of the films that you guys talk about. And that movie, I would have assumed, was entirely computer-generated, given it's on another planet. Maybe I'm wrong. How is it that Avatar was impacted if they are not actually using concrete equipment and locations?
I'd have to check the exact documentation on that, but there was definitely... Avatar was on our list from the Department of Defense for support, and it's I think probably because there are things like the helicopter gunships, some kind of aerial vehicles in that, and sometimes bear in mind that they just do offer advice and things like that, like, because what the Department of Defense is quite keen to do is make sure that everyone's got their ribbons on straight and that the uniforms are correct and that the language that's used is appropriate, and do you know what I mean, like, the, you know, so the chain of command is properly represented and things like that. Mm-hmm. And often film producers want that kind of information to make sure that they don't say, you know, put any words in characters' mouths that make them seem really silly, because they're trying to create authentic script. So I can't remember the exact details off the top of my head with Avatar. It was definitely on the DOD list.
No, but that's excellent. So that's a good reminder that it's not just equipment. It is also, as you say, all of the minutiae of the details of how to present military life accurately.
Yeah, I mean, everyone values that. I mean, it points to the kind of importance of the military. And how much they are needed by the producers. I mean, all of the people, you know, Hollywood loves this arrangement. It means that they get cheap equipment that looks brilliant, and they don't have to use computers. They don't have to spend the time and the money on using computers. And the military loves it because it makes them look good, and it gives them recruitment, allows them to recruit soldiers, but it also allows them on the quiet to manipulate history and the reputation of their own, the representation of their own organizations and their and the state. So everyone wins, really. I mean, no one loses in these kind of arrangements, except for, of course, the movie going public.
Right. So a couple thoughts. One is that the military is paid for with American taxes, and if they go ahead and agree to allow some of our military material and experts and whatnot to be used to help produce a Hollywood film, the Hollywood film producers, it sounds like they're not necessarily paying like top dollar for the use of those things. So in a way, it's almost a tax subsidy of allowing those resources to be used by Hollywood at a reduced rate, so long as the proper messaging is being offered up by the movie. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is fair, I think. A lot of people consider this to be something that goes against First Amendment rights, because, you know, it's manipulating information without by favoring one form of free speech over another.
Mm-hmm. Or one narrative is definitely being put in front of the public repetitively over and over. I mean, World War II, there must be ample evidence of the use of Hollywood during, leading up to and during World War II to encourage and inspire the American people to support the war and the soldiers and blah, blah, blah. I guess the question is like, the blatancy. Like, if it's blatant and obvious and you know what's going on, then you can say, I know that this is designed to sway my opinion in a particular direction, and I'll choose whether or not to be swayed. But if you don't know that it's going on, and it's happening in all these movies that you watch and you're not aware that it's happening, then you're actually, that's where I think the term manipulation comes in.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I don't particularly object to any organization having, a supportive role in the creation of television or film or whatever. You know, we live in the real world. Maybe you do need a helicopter or whatever. But the fact is that it's being done so quietly. I mean, it's hard to say that it's kind of classified exactly because it's not. It's just done very, very quietly. I mean, the full list of CIA cooperation, which runs to about 50 since since its existence, didn't come to light until the last couple of years. The Department of Defense, like I say, everyone assumed that there was just a couple of hundred or so at the turn of the century, but actually, it's now up to the th it's nearly 2,000. So, and none of the and very few of the scripts are actually available for analysis showing where those changes have been made. There are some prominent examples of films like Zero Dark Thirty, for example, where the media actually did their job and well, Judicial Watch initially, a right-wing sort of accuracy and media style organization, contacted but kicked up a lot of fuss. Used the Freedom of Information Act and acquired a lot of documentation about that film and showed how involved the Central Intelligence Agency and Department of Defense had been in creating that, the Bin Laden assassination movie. But, a lot of the time, the documentation on this is absent. In fact, there's a library at Georgetown University which contains many of the scripts, if not all of the vast majority, at least, of the available material from the 20th century, all the way up to around about the year 2000, but in dribs and drabs beyond. Now that is a in a public library, but it is being it is under the jurisdiction of a private individual. The private individual is just a private historian, happens to be, kind of very sympathetic, I would say, to the aims of the American state. And no one's seen that material. I mean, I don't know anyone. I mean, I'm in this research field. I don't know anyone who's been granted access to that library in, 15 plus years. So, a lot of the, and that's where the vast majority of the relevant information is.
That's
So
fascinating. And so it's a public library, but controlled by an individual.
the actual archive is controlled by an individual, and he has written several large books, which have basically dominated and completely characterized this whole field over the past several decades. But of course, that means that basically the entire historiography of this, what I think is a very important area of serious propaganda, surreptitious propaganda, has been dominated by one person, and that person happens to be someone who's kept all of the documentation without seeming willing to share it in any way for a
Right.
very long period of time, and hasn't himself actually published anything for well over a decade. So,
And so not it's
what's
not
going
just
on?
him. It's not just him though, because if he's writing books about his opinion of these pieces of information which he hoards for himself and does not share with others, those books are then going to be referenced by students who are going to college and learning about the subject matter. And so they will probably believe what they read and go on to, promote it as fact or accurate without having been able to look at the actual primary source material.
I completely agree. It has been quite a damaging thing for the whole field. And it's meant that even historians and analysts who are generally quite critical of the American sort of war-making machine, if you like, are reluctant to be particularly reluctant to jump to the obvious conclusions about the scale, size, interventionist nature of the propaganda apparatus. I mean, I think that, I mean, I'm being kind to myself and Tom here, I suppose, but that's what's different about this book. We are not it's not a conspiracy theory in any way because it is based on the documentation, but we're not going to be afraid of saying, look, there is this script here for a film. Say Charlie Wilson's War is a good example. Now, we don't have the specific documentation that shows where any organization has put a pen through different bits of the script, but we can say, look, here is the script as it was originally written a year before it came out. Here is the shooting script. Something has changed here. We know that the CIA, we now know, several years after it actually happened, and you didn't really know at the time, but we know that the CIA was involved. What, you know, what is going to have changed that script? At least to some extent, that's going to be government involvement. And we're trying to draw common sense inferences from the limited, but we believe sufficient material to put together this jigsaw puzzle. And it's the same with a whole heap of other of other films.
Now, hold on a second. I'm just thinking about something. Is that probably it's not considered acceptable for the Department of Defense or the CIA or these organizations to literally provide cash funding to a Hollywood movie? Do you have any examples of where they literally say, here, we're going to throw, you know, $40 million at your movie? I'm assuming that doesn't happen. Okay, okay.
But
so wait. So if that doesn't happen, you said earlier that people in Hollywood like to have someone who can come on board and give them advice about how to make sure the uniforms look right, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting here thinking we have decades and decades of these movies being made. There's obviously people who are just common. What is it called? What am I? I'm not in the military, therefore I am.
Consultant?
No, just a normal civilian.
Civilian.
There's obviously civilians and retired military people out there who are completely 100% capable of providing that information to the producer of a movie. But then they would have to hire these people to come in and actually pay money for them to consult, like you hire someone to do your costuming or your set design. Now, if they're going to the military and the military is giving them this advice, technically for free, really, that's actually causing them to not have to hire someone. So it's de facto a way of making it easier for them to financially afford to make their movie, which essentially means funding.
Yes, I think that is fair comment. There are several quite prominent, you might be interested to know, several quite prominent ex-military people like Dale Dye, you often see on the credits to movies. Mm-hmm. And he's the kind of person who comes in when there isn't official Department of Defense involvement, so not officially any script rewrites, but he's like an unofficial consultant.
Sure.
And sometimes the CIA does that as well. They don't always do it through their formal channels. Mm-hmm. That they just, you know, someone else comes up. In the case of Enemy of the State is an interesting example that you know, had no one had ever picked up on. Obscure little news report from 1998, the Will Smith movie. The NSA had a contractor who went out and ensured that the film did not blame the NSA for all of the nasty surveillance that was going on, in that it was a rogue entity within the NSA that was specifically blamed. And so the producers sort of said, you know, we had this consultant come along, and you know, it's unclear exactly who this person was or what his or her existing tie was to the National Security Agency, but they were obviously there to prevent it from being quite such a politicized piece of work.
Well,
so
now,
that kind of thing does happen all the time, but I agree with you that it probably is a way of saving a little bit of money, yeah.
Yeah, and then we've got obviously the movie Citizen Four and Edward Snowden. So Citizen Four is the documentary about Edward Snowden, actually has him in it. And then Edward Snowden, I think, is the name of the movie that has that wonderful actor I adore and love. And so that's a Hollywood movie. That movie would be what? Would that be an example of someone in Hollywood saying, not interested in you coming in and changing my script because I plan to out you for what you've been doing. So leave me alone and I'm going to do what I want. Is that an example of successful artistic freedom?
Well, both of those films, Citizen Four and Snowden by Oliver Stone, they wouldn't have even thought to have contacted the military, let alone any of the clandestine services, to bother them with anything, because they know that they would have been ignored or passed off very quickly. Oliver Stone is someone who's been fighting against that kind of dominant ideology, the national security state mentality, for 3 decades.
Yes, let's talk about Oliver Stone for a second. Go for it.
Okay, so Oliver Stone's a good example in his film Snowden, which but he's been working for 3 decades fighting against the that kind of national security state mentality. And he was saying at an award ceremony recently that usually you lose when you do this, and he was quite kind of philosophical about it. I mean, there was a long period of time, and this isn't just about the military and or any of that, but there was a period of well over a decade where Oliver Stone just moved away from doing anything high profile political after he had done JFK and Nixon, big conspiracy movies. And, he's basically admitting, it's just exhausting, absolutely draining to try and work within that kind of creative milieu, but making challenging political narratives. So, he's an example. But yeah, and the same thing with Citizen Four, the other Oliver, the other Edward Snowden movie. They wouldn't have bothered to, wouldn't have even thought, wouldn't even about asking any of the government entities to help them with that. Plus, of course, it was a documentary, and I suppose that's something to mention as well. That actually, I mean, I certainly am not someone who wants to bewail the situation of, the industry, or say that it's got worse or anything like that. In fact, if anything, the explosion in high quality documentaries over the past 15 years has been really exciting to see. So, there are a lot of, I'd say that there's actually a lot of very good things to watch in from Los Angeles and from the United States generally. I think a lot of the TV series are absolutely amazing. I rewatched Breaking Bad at the weekend. It completely destroyed my entire weekend. But you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of excellent material out there. I mean, this sort of this military kind of militaristic national security sort of is a bit of a toxin, as far as I'm concerned. It's kind of it's part of the cultural milieu. It's unfortunate, but it is only a bit of it. It's just a much, much bigger bit than anyone had previously ever said. Because this hasn't even been part of the national conversation. I mean, like, as
Right.
most of us just didn't know anything about this. There's no debate about it. It's not in the New York Times or Washington Post how there's this large, significant, multi-talent propaganda machine which is plugging into people's brains all the time through entertainment. I mean,
Right.
it's your
Right.
issue, but it's not. And but equally, I wouldn't want to say that it's bigger than it is, because actually, the bigger world is that the entertainment system does also throw up some decent stuff.
Right. So really quickly, for folks who've just joined us, I want to make sure you know who you're listening to. So this is Marge Twisdell, and as you know, I'm the producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. And today I'm talking with Matthew Alford, who is the co-writer of National Security Cinema: The Shocking New Evidence of Government Control in Hollywood. This is a book that specifically points to new information gained in just the past few years with the Freedom of Information Act. And as Matt was just saying, really highlights a much larger impact than what people believed was being had. So we have about one quarter of the show ahead of us, and you have children. So real quick, I'm wondering, how do you, not obviously as a person who's written this book, and I'm sure your kids hear an earful, but in general, how would you want to sort of realistically present this awareness to youth? What can parents say that will empower their children to enjoy the movie while not being taken advantage
Oh, that's a really difficult one, because
of?
giving parenting advice is a perilous area.
Okay. Not
No,
parenting
I'm very
advice.
happy to try it. It's a good
I
question.
know. Well, it's sort of like, what do you do? Let's go back to that.
Okay, so one thing is, I don't mind quite so much, in the sense that my kids are British, so they are not going to be recruited into the American military. So one half of that is less of an issue. I would say if you are from a military family, then that's a separate thing. You just have your discussions about the nature of the military and what that means.
Right.
It's away from the cultural kind of impact, I guess. It's your thing. I mean, these sort of recruitment is a personal issue. The thing that bothers me a little more than recruitment, partly because I'm British rather than American, but also because I'm kind of concerned about the biggest thing, is the rewriting of history. And I think that is something it's just worth having open discussion with all the time, with your kids. I mean, I do that kind of constantly with my children. I mean, I hope this doesn't come out wrongly, but at the moment we are reading the Bible together, and we are not religious particularly, but I thought it would be useful to read the Bible as taking it on face value as what it was. And there are some moments in it which are actually quite kind of funny because the Bible is quite a dark book, because of the power of God and just the whole nature of it is quite crazy. So there, I mean, I would probably adopt the same kind of attitude to showing films. I think it's perfectly good for children to be exposed to lots of different forms of violence and challenging ideas and weirdness and things like that, as long as you're with them and you can talk it through with them. Obviously, there are limits to that as well. You don't want to be showing them Batman, when they're 7. But I think a lot can be done just through good communication, basically. I don't know if I can say anything better than that.
Right. So a lot of my listeners who perhaps have not read the book, and they're like, okay, I don't want to come across to my kids like, I'm overreacting. I haven't read the book. I may not have time in the next month to read the book. And, my kids are looking forward to such and such a movie that's coming out. Like you mentioned the Avengers series and stuff. So, a lot of the movies that are mentioned are definitely geared towards kids. So, what would be one simple way that a parent could, I'm thinking maybe an example. Like, if there was a really cool example that you could point out and say, blah, blah, blah was changed for blah, 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 isn't that sort of interesting? And just know that maybe happens in other movies too. What might be the best kid-friendly example that might stick in the kid's head and help
The
them?
quickest one that I can think of, if you read in our book, is about Iron Man. Now, I can't remember the specifics on this, so I'll just say it quickly. But Iron Man, originally, the script was, he was a real pacifist superhero. He wanted to completely get rid of his whole armaments division. He didn't want to be an arms dealer anymore. Now, in the movie, he's basically becomes, tanked up as a great big super strong man that goes around ki killing terrorists in Afghanistan. Now there's a huge shift there, away from pacifist superhero who wants to take down the arms industry to basically using all of his weapons to create a sort of super Iron Man character who goes around blowing up alleged terrorists. Now, if that kind of change can happen in the production process, you've got to be aware of what the kind of manipulate, basically, when the state is involved in the production of anything, they're going to be liable to make it a much more state-friendly, military-friendly piece of work. And so just be wary of that, I guess.
Right, and getting away from the military piece, but really that state piece, what we're talking about is essentially politics. If you want to continue to have sort of endless war in the Middle East in order to gain continual power and access to the oil resources in the region, you need the people of your country to back you up. So it's really beneficial if you can have a whole bunch of movies that are reinforcing the stereotypes and the definitely stereotypes and some of the false narratives that will just keep people engaged in that goal.
I'll give you one other example as well. I mean, I think anyone who has seen the Terminator series, show them Terminator 1 and or Terminator 2, and then show them Terminator 4 Salvation. Which one has had massive military support. Obviously, the fourth one is absolute creative dross. Terrible, terrible movie. I think that it's almost like I'd be surprised if just inherently 90% of human beings would watch those movies and just say, oh my goodness, the first two movies are great because they are anti-nuclear, they are suspicious of authority, they have integrity, they are properly a creative vision. And then the fourth one is basically PR for the Department of Defense. You know, completely clueless, incoherent, public relations sort of, you know, just wipe clean Teflon, you know, that's a really good example. But well, pretty much all of these movies that go through the PR process of the state are trashed, are ruined, creatively as well as politically.
So that's fascinating when you mentioned, I mean, I'll have to go watch that fourth one because I did watch the first one a long time ago. And then the second one, I really like the second one a lot. And I think I have a vague memory of watching the third, and I didn't go any further, so I haven't seen that fourth one. So when you mention, oh gosh, what was that one we were just talking about? Iron Man. I actually can't stand Iron Man.
Yeah, I can't stand it either.
Okay, I just really, everything about it rubs me wrong. I think I've made it one third of the way through one of the movies, and that's it. Except when he shows up in other movies, I don't watch Iron Man series. But what I found interesting when you mentioned that the original story as written shows him this pacifist who's going to be out to basically use his influence and power to eliminate those types of dangerous powers. And you're right, now it's turning into a huge international global thing that's going to protect. Yeah, it's interesting where it's gone. I wonder what happens to the writers. How do the writers feel when they produce something and, you know, Hollywood says, yes, this is great. And then over the next 18 months, as it goes through revisions and whatnot, it comes out completely different. What is the mood in the world of writers? Are they like responding or reacting to this?
You probably are aware that writers have zero power really in the Hollywood system. I can't swear on your show, but all of the quotes that I've come across about writers from anyone who knows anything about the industry say that they are treated like dirt, basically. They're basically glorified typists, they're often called. I think writers take the check, such as it is, and run. And they accept that there's not really anything they can do. And, you know, that's bad, I guess, but it's the nature of the beast. But, you know, that's why I'm sort of saying, you know, I'm not opposed to Hollywood. I just think it's the, you know, but we shouldn't have these organizations metastasizing around the edge of Hollywood. That would be such a, to prevent the influence of the Department of Defense, for example, to discourage that, would be a major step in creating, a small but significant step in creating a better, more accountable, and ultimately more creative and more enjoyable entertainment system, particularly in movies.
So the United States of America, I don't have the exact numbers, but I'm very, very close, has something around 650 or 700 military bases around the planet. I think our nearest country that is anywhere close is either China or Russia with about 200 or 150 or something. And everyone else has like 12 or 8 or something. So we're clearly the dominant military presence on the planet at this point. And Hollywood produces a lot of military-friendly and military-promoting movies. Now, one of my questions, this is sort of the final question almost of the show, is that there are some movies being produced in, you know, Bollywood from India. There's movies coming out of China and Japan and the UK and Europe. Do you see a really big difference between the type of movies that are coming out of countries that don't have huge military-industrial complex powers at play compared to Hollywood?
Yes, in the sense that the American film industry is kind of unique in terms of size and also in terms of the scale of the military involvement in those productions, but also in terms of budgets and things like that. Most other nations have quite limited budgets for their movies that that they make. So they don't really have the money to make massive, you know, to have an aircraft carrier. And even if the country owns an aircraft carrier, it doesn't tend to happen. I haven't actually seen very many movies from China. I probably should. But I'm just not aware of how sort of bombastic or gung-ho they are, although China's had long had a reputation for being quite a conservative country, you know, without imperial ambitions, even though it has had some impact in Africa and elsewhere. I'd say that, the American militarized culture in terms of cinema and TV is quite pronounced, I think, even compared to somewhere like Britain. Which, you know, has been engaged in many of the same overseas conflicts and has had a severe sort of imperial past. But you know, the same kind of principle does run throughout the world, though. I mean, anytime you have a powerful entity like a government, they're going to be trying to protect their interests and protect their reputation and to promote it. I mean, look at what the James Bond franchise is. I mean, that's British in its origination. And that's, you know, something that is, you know, kind of designed to appeal to a kind of glorious imperial past of the United Kingdom. I do think, though, that it is the case that whether in America or in the rest of the world, the less money that is spent on the production, the more it tends to have the opportunity for more dissent. So every time you've got a sort of budget of less than, say, 10 million, you know, you get more independent films. And for one reason or another, they tend to be much more imaginative and interesting and are less dependent on and just simply don't have the need for kind of military. I mean, it's a mixed bag, but if you look at, I mean, it's a bit of an old example now, but I'm thinking of The Constant Gardener or indeed the Snowden film or a lot of Oliver Stone's things. Starship Troopers, that was slightly higher budget, but, you know, anything with a lower budget tends to be kind of more interesting creatively, I tend to find.
What ideas might you have around laws that could be changed in order to ameliorate this effect or to protect artistic integrity? And do you see a solution or an option?
I think that there's the simplest law that I can think of is just dead easy. I think that if a film or TV show has had support from one of the major entities, CIA, DOD, or indeed White House. I mean, the White House did actually provide money for a short period of time under the Clinton administration to various TV series to promote the war on drugs. Would you believe? Crazy thing that was exposed by Salon magazine in the year 2000. In TV series like ER and Beverly Hills 90210 and things like this. But there's a simple solution. They should just say at the beginning of the film or TV series, produced in cooperation with the Department of Defense or whoever. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that's done, I think you'll find that they'll lose about 3/4 of their audience because no one wants to be propagandized. No one wants to know that they're being manipulated.
Well, no, they do want to know that they are being manipulated. They just may not choose to continue to engage.
Bad form of words, yes.
Right. Yeah. Wow, thank you. I'm so glad I asked you that question.
Good question.
Yeah, I mean, because that's within the purview. I mean, that doesn't limit anyone's behavior. It simply makes it become, it's sort of like you have to say if a movie is PG or rated R or things like that.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, it'd be very interesting to say, you know, wow, I like that idea. I suppose if they're, okay, that's a cool idea.
There's obviously one other thing that I think as a researcher should be definitely done, which is that there should be all the documentation that is relevant should be made accessible, surely by law, through, you know, just through the spirit of the Freedom of Information Act. Mm-hmm. There should be better material made available. It's kind of crazy that it isn't. But then that's not to criticize your country any more than any other. I mean, look at the British Freedom of Information Act is, it takes a very long time to acquire information, and it doesn't always come up. And, you know, it's the same with our film industry and TV industry. It's hard to acquire information. So It's just the way of the world, I'm afraid. But we can get there by continually chipping away with it.
Well, I am so grateful that you were able to take about, an hour and a half out of your life to join us on Prose, Poetry, and Purpose and share so many of the background details behind this book.
Well, I hope it was of interest to your listeners. Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, that's our show, folks. My name is March Twisdale, and you've been listening to my interview with Matthew Alford, who is one of the co— Oh, you were going to give me your Facebook page. So Matthew is one of the co-writers of National Security Cinema, The Shocking New Evidence of Government Control in Hollywood. This is a really great book and is available in various ways. But you said you have a Facebook page where people
Yeah,
can go to?
if you want to click like on facebook.com/ the writer with no hands, then that's where I put out usually a story each day that's relevant from the news to do with war, cinema, entertainment, assassination, those kind of issues that are all in this book.
That is awesome because you are, as you said earlier, and people may not have caught this if they joined us later, you are a college professor and have been working in this field of academia for a very long time, correct?
Yeah, it has crept up on me a little bit, but yeah, it's around about 15 years that I've been working on in this field of propaganda theory, with a particular interest in the role of entertainment in spreading manipulation, particularly by powerful entities like the government.
Excellent. And your co-writer, Tom Secker, Secker, where exactly can they go for his website?
Go to spyculture.com. And that, I mean, what
Okay.
Tom's done has been terrific because he has provided all of the documentation. So this is several thousand pages of documentation that I've just based everything I've just said off the top of my head just then. It's
Got it.
all on that website. It was uploaded about a couple of weeks ago. So do feel free to go there. And if you find anything amongst that documentation, or if you put in an FOI that's relevant to this, please do drop us a line because we'd love to hear from you. This to do this perfectly or to do this really well, we do need a whole crowd of people to get involved. I mean, I'm really proud of the book, but the book should be 10,000 pages long, and it's whatever 300 pages. So please, if you find information, do feel free to get in touch, particularly if you get the original source data.
And for all of my writers out there who like to listen to the show and get ideas from fellow writers, think about it. If you're doing anything that deals with spy culture, this is great primary core information that you can go read through and maybe it'll inspire your next novel. All right, folks, thanks for listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guests share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time.
You come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage.